From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. Millions of Americans are passing through the nation's airports today, some encountering new security measures for the first time. The full-body scans and aggressive pat-downs are even drawing the attention of lawmakers who want to know if there's a better way to keep us safe. Is this a political minefield for Congress? And so much for the holidays keeping the politicians away. Sarah Palin will be in Iowa this weekend, while Mike Huckabee spoke to a prominent Iowa conservative group on Sunday. Both could be contenders next year, but the Bushes like Romney. We'll discuss the latest political news next on The Exchange, but first, the news. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. It's Politics Day, and my guests are Bruce Gronbeck, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, and Stefan Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon,
Good
Janine.
Afternoon, Janine.
Thanks for being
here.
Hi, Bruce, and hi, Janine. Well,
hi,
gentlemen, I thought we might begin our conversation this afternoon with the conflict in Korea. President Barack Obama dispatched an aircraft carrier to take part in exercises off the Korean Peninsula to show strength after North Korea fired an artillery onto South Korean soil for the first time in half a century. This is a country that has perplexed president after president, administration after administration. Was this the right move? Stefan, let me begin with you.
The United States has lost all credibility, I think, with North Korea because they, as well as Iran, have been playing the nuclear game very well. They retreat when it looks like they're going to get slapped, and they proceed forward again when things have cooled down. And I don't think we have a lot of leverage. So sending, you know, a military presence and doing some maneuvering off the coast is the least we could do. But I think the North Koreans have figured out that we are as much about bluffing as maybe they are, because people think that these the shelling of the island and the revelation of their new and surprising enrichment facility are just an effort for them to reestablish that they do whatever they want, and that the heir apparent, the young new emperor of North Korea, who will take over soon, will continue the same policies.
Well, Bruce, let me ask you. Stefan just mentioned the uranium enrichment facility. It appears the United States was caught off guard by that. Is there more that we can do or should do? I've read reports where they say, look, if we do too much, it sends a bad signal, or it makes China angry. Or if we do too little, we look weak, and then North Korea continues with this. And what do they want?
Well, who knows what they want besides prestige recognition, a major presence in East Asia. Sure. It seems to me the United States at this point is relying on pretty traditional international political rhetoric. On the one hand, it talks, and it uses various forums. It's using the six-nation negotiation process, running to the UN and trying to talk loudly via the airwaves. And then it goes through a series of actions, a kind of political performance, and that can involve a destroyer this time around, maneuvers. It can make some more attempts to isolate North Korea through boycotts and of various kinds. But our options are really, frankly, limited until something, I think, overpowering begins to happen. And until, for example, that nuclear facility is actually shown to be producing something that we then can see in for example, atomic tests or hydrogen tests, we will sit and complain about it bitterly. Hope you can choke a country without actually destroying its people, which is very hard to do, it seems to me. I think the United States is in a bad spot, and if the world is looking for the United States to solve this problem, they're going to wait an awful long time.
Mm-hmm. We'd like to invite you to join our conversation today or ask a question or make a comment at 1-866-780-9100. Again, the number 1-866-780-9100. Or, of course, you can email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Find us on Twitter at IPRTalk. There have been minimal casualties, and not to dismiss those that have died, but there have been the death tolls at about 4. There are, however, 25,000 American troops stationed in South Korea. Should we be worried about that, Stefan? Is that an issue, or are they, because of where they're at and because largely this is a lot of saber rattling right now, safe?
Well, nobody is safe with North Korea because they do not behave in a conventional way. They are a society that operates on entirely different rules. So, no, I don't think they're safe. But their purpose has always been to be what we call a tripwire to prevent a land invasion of South Korea by the North. Because if they did that, then the United States would retaliate with presumably massive military retaliation against the North. And I think they're probably still sane enough to understand that that would mean nuclear weapons, and that would mean that the military and a lot of the remaining infrastructure of North Korea would be pretty much wiped out. So hopefully there are still enough in the military in North Korea to realize that confronting the United States here is just about the last thing they want to do, because that will then end the dynasty, and it will bring North Korea really to its knees. So I guess I'm hoping this is a continuation of that traditional sort of game that the North Koreans have played of belligerence, you know, and secrecy and independence. And at this point, they're dependent on China for almost everything because they've alienated everybody else. So I guess the strategy appears to be that the U.S. is more interested in negotiating with China so that they'll come and smack the North Korean regime, because we clearly have not been able to actually do it.
Right. And I mean, the game is an amazing game if you think about it all. All through that, the how far can North Korea go in what it does to indicate that it is a powerful, aggressive nation without getting into trouble, even as it blows hot and cold on the so-called sunshine policy between the two Koreas as they try to negotiate a kind of working relationship where North Korea can at least get some food and other kinds of material out of the South while letting people visit each other, and a series of other moves. It's a game that has been going on now for just about 60 years, showing no signs of abating. And the rest of the world watches in frustration. But again, unless you want to take the ultimate move. You know, and for the second time in world history, pull out the nuclear weapons. The situation for those who aren't in Korea is very, very frustrating.
All right. Well, let's take a quick call on this before we move on. Terry is calling from Missouri. Terry, thank you so much for calling the exchange.
Yes, I'd like to know what's the bad side. Say North Korea were to launch a full attack, what happens then?
Stefan, I think you kind of mentioned this.
I think so. I mean, I think the United States does not have the capability of fighting a land war in Korea. You know, the North Koreans have a million troops under arms. They have the capacity of breaking through the DMZ, and physically they have enough artillery aimed at South Korea that they can wipe out the South Korean capital. And so the only thing that you really can do in a situation like this, I think, is to use the maximum clout that you have. And maybe it doesn't have to be nuclear weapons, but there would have to be a very swift and massive military strike against the North to stop them from penetrating the South. And you know, it's a very, very dangerous situation.
And it's compounded by, it seems to me, by the development in North Korea of longer-range ballistic missiles, which now has Australia, for example, worried that it can be reached. And you begin to make not just the usual parts of the Pacific Rim jittery, but now almost the entire southern hemisphere. And it is a situation that I hate to agree, but I agree that the United States would probably be forced into pretty drastic action if North Korea decided it was time to really make a strong move on South Korea.
Terry, did you have another question?
Yes. Would we use the first nuclear weapons? Would this country ever do that?
Well, I don't think it would, actually. It's already done that, and I don't think it was a pleasant. It wasn't a pleasant matter for this country to think about once it did and thought about what it had done. I don't think first strike is any more in a vocabulary of the American military or its civilian leadership. I don't think so.
All right. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Janine Beck, sitting in for Ben Kiefer today. It's Politics Day, and my guests are Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Bruce Gronbeck, professor emeritus of communication studies at the University of Iowa. Well, gentlemen, as we speak, millions of Americans are boarding planes or disembarking planes as they travel for the holiday. And despite the threat of disruption caused by the National Opt-Out Day protests, lines at most airport security checkpoints appeared to be moving normally earlier this morning anyway, according to media reports from Chicago, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Arizona, San Francisco. So what's all the fuss about these body scanners? Is it all for naught? Stefan, let me just begin with you.
Well, it is just simply a sign of the times, and Americans may be in complete denial. We are living in a world where asymmetrical threats against national security, the infrastructure, airplanes, is a reality. And it isn't going to go away. It isn't going to get less. We're never going to go down from orange to, green. Or blue or whatever the categories are in our alert system that have never been used since September 11. If anything else, I think we're going to end up with category red very soon. I talked with an Iowan who was a CIA operative in the clandestine service for many years. He was a speaker yesterday here at the Iowa Association of Rural Cooperatives, where I was also a speaker. And we talked a little bit before because I know him. He has come here and given talks before. And he said, frankly, we are at the highest risk we've ever been, and that people need to just simply realize that these are measures that are probably necessary. And I grew up in Colombia, South America. And frankly, in Colombia, when you went into any major building, a bank, a government building, and any office building, you were actually patted down as vigorously as Americans are now being patted down at the airport. And we sort of got used to it. You know, it was just you understood that the option, if you didn't do that, was that lives would be in danger. And I think the news media is doing a very, very bad job of stoking the outrage, of showing all the cases where people have, in fact, not been treated very well. And if that deters us from carrying out a robust security regime, we're going to be very sorry, because somebody is going to get on a plane and they're going to blow it up or divert it. And, then what do you think the news media would do if that TSA officer did not search that person thoroughly enough and they got on a plane with a bomb? The news story would be the TSA is not doing a sufficient job. So this
sure
is a no-win situation.
But one of the questions then, Bruce, I have for you is, Stefan's sort of saying, look, get over it. We have to do this to be safe. But on the other hand, one of the things I've read is the TSA did not give people some warning ahead of time. We're worried that if they talked about these full body scanners, if they talked about the new pat down methods, that it would alert terrorists to which airports they were being used at. And while that may be a valid concern, would the public have been more ready for this, more understanding if they had had some heads up. Like, look, we're worried about the very threat Stefan's mentioning, right, and so this is the additional steps we're going to be taking. I mean, would we have handled it better as a public?
While Stefan was talking, I wrote down the word preparation. And the TSA, you're absolutely right, did almost literally nothing to prepare the American public for this set of procedures at a high travel time in the country when a lot of other things are happening. Sure, we heard about full body scanners slowly, but again, it wasn't really talk about it. And what they were doing now, we come back, once the uproar is hit about the tests that have been done and the safety of these scans and on and on and on. And then on top of that, not even the people flying the planes, right, were prepared. So they complained bitterly. Pilots and flight personnel complained and get exempted. So you have all this turmoil. The Homeland Security itself simply didn't prepare the public for it. I'm glad to hear that people are actually may actually get home today. Because the other part is, right, that roughly 85% of the populace said this is fine, and we could stop and talk about the internet able to build communities among people who never meet face to face, but let's just hold on the main topic.
But Bruce, everybody, there's a ton of information about how you should prepare when you go to the airport. And I fly a lot. I travel a lot to conferences and other things. I see people come in there who should be basically expelled from the airport. They've got studded belts. They've got pants with all kinds of big metal things on them. They've got necklaces on that would set off, a heart monitor. They are carrying water bottles and trying to carry them through the line. They don't have their little bottles in their little Ziploc bags.
But that's kind of Bruce's point that on a holiday weekend.
Pardon me?
But that's kind of his point that on a weekend in which average people now travel, and I'm saying families or not people like you who might travel more often or regularly for business, was this the time to institute that? And yes, in some ways, because then this might be the more time a terrorist plots against us, but if they had talked about it, you might not be as annoyed with these people who show up completely dressed inappropriately.
No, I agree with Stefan. I get annoyed with them every time I'm in
line. People don't pay any attention to anything, and they think, like the guy who is conducting this boycott or who wants people to refuse to be scanned, they're a bunch of whiners who it's my way or nobody's way, and I have my rights. We don't have any rights left in the United States. Don't you realize that? Do you think your email or your cell phones are now still confidential? They're not. We have a tremendous security regime that's built around the aftermath of September 11. We have very, very intrusive scrutiny of all kinds of private information, and that this is not your father's United States when it comes to civil liberties and to privacy. This is the United States of post September 11.
Let's talk about the political ramifications then of this. And I do want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. If you have a question or comment about this or want to weigh in, 1-866-780-9100. Members of Congress are now weighing in on this. And I don't know if they're feeling political pressure or if it's just because they fly and they're citizens too and they're concerned about this. They all sort of preface their comments, well, we've got to be concerned about safety, but is this the way we want to go? And Senator Charles Grassley actually spoke about it yesterday morning on his weekly conference call with reporters and suggested that, he doesn't really want to be pat down if he can avoid it. He'd rather go through the scanner and then, if something alerts them to a problem, be patted down. But let's listen to what he had to say.
There's some piece of equipment over there that they think does a better job without this sort of humiliation, that you just walk through it and it will detect anything like what the Amsterdam bomber would have had. They bought it in Boston. Can you believe that? Now, we aren't using it. So Chambliss and Collins write to the Secretary of Homeland Security a couple times and still doesn't have an answer why we aren't using this.
That's Senator Charles Grassley, and he's talking about two of his Senate colleagues, Susan Collins of Maine and Saxby Chambliss of Georgia, who went to the Netherlands recently and discovered they're using a much different screening device that they felt was far less intrusive, and then discovered, as he said, that it was built here in the United States.
And it doesn't
what
work.
Do you, go ahead.
That screening device has, there's already, you know, all the evidence is back that it draws a stick figure of you instead of showing a picture of you with all the physical characteristics. And the error rate in missing things that you are trying to carry onto a plane is unacceptably high. So, you know, I mean, there isn't any magic solution here. And by the way, Senator Grassley should never have to go through any security screening. He is a United States senator. It is not very likely that he's going to hijack a plane. We have millions of people in this country who should be exempted from it. The, you know, Secretary Napolitano,
I disagree.
Who is in
I
head
understand
of
what
the-
you're saying, that he should be exempted because he travels so often. He's a member of Congress. But on the other hand, I would want him, as a member of Congress, to go through it on occasion so that they know what it's like. I mean, I don't think that they should pass laws and then not have any realistic expectation of what it's like to stand in that line.
Well,
that doesn't
seem reasonable any laws.
To me.
They didn't pass any laws. This was a TSA administrative regulation. The Congress created the TSA, but they gave them the option of how they carry out airport security.
Well, I realize. I'm just saying, if they don't live like us a little bit, they certainly can't speak for us on the House
and
Senate floor.
Well, then I think Senator Grassley should go to Afghanistan and put on body armor and carry a 100-pound pack and go out and try to kill Taliban, too. You know,
all right, Bruce, jump in here.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the politics is pretty typical. We're going to see an awful lot of huffing and puffing. But members of Congress are going to ask for both security and personal liberty. And they'll lay out those values and say, I'm for both of them. Do something right. And, of course, they'll have no suggestions whatsoever. The notion that there will be somehow new legislation is ridiculous. This is just a chance to sound good on the air and then go home and eat your turkey.
That's
pat
right.
us on the head and then ignore
yes.
us.
Yeah.
Let's hear from Jacob really, really quick. Jacob, thanks so much for calling The Exchange.
Hi. I was wanting to talk about, you guys are talking about the invasiveness of these body scanners. And, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of agree with the perspective of, you know, there's terror out there. That's a legitimate threat. We need to be prepared for it. And, well, how else are you going to find about bombs and various threats? But, moreover, how TSA handles these body scans is kind of a fear of mine. Recently, Gizmodo released 100 photographs of a 2-millimeter wave scanner put out by Bridget Systems, where U.S. Marshals illegally stored up to 35,000 images of public scans taken. And I don't see why.
So you're
that would
concerned
be at all
about
necessary.
Not so sure. You're concerned. Okay, maybe I'd be willing to go through this if I felt like they were doing it discreetly and handling it appropriately. But sometimes you don't feel they do.
Well, TSA has
exactly.
really insisted that there is no way that the machines that they are using now can record and store images.
Yep.
That you know they certainly are taking pictures, but they are those disappear. That's almost like an urban legend that's floating around that all of these have come from TSA operated scanning machines. They really are now. Of course, what do I know? But they certainly are insisting that. Nowhere are they putting machines that can do that. So I wouldn't worry too much about it.
All right. Bruce, Stefan, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. Remember, you can join us at 1-866-780-9100. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. My guests today for Politics Day are Bruce Gronbeck, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, and Stefan Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Before the break, we were discussing National Opt-Out Day, which has not so far turned out to be as hectic as many people were thinking it might be. This was in relation to people concerned about the full body scanners and the pat down methods TSA employees are using at the airports to try to assure some safety in flights. We got a call from Derek in Fairfield. Derek, thanks for calling the Exchange.
Oh, thank you, Janine.
You're a little concerned with the tack we were taking. You're not so sure these are keeping us safe.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I honestly don't see how we can feel safe when every time we go into an airport, we're kind of treated like criminals. We're patted down, we're radiated with scanners, and quite honestly, I just don't feel like that's making anyone feel safe. To be honest, I feel like there's a lack of creativity in resolving our security issues, and I think, you know, simple examples like programming the airplanes with an emergency override so that they have a holding pattern instead of getting crashed in the buildings, and keeping armed marshals and, you know, citizens aware on planes so that if someone does try to pull anything, they get tackled. I just feel like we're pretending like we're a little bit weaker than we really are, and I think it's kind of an insult.
All right, Derek, thanks so much for your time. One of the things that I thought was interesting, the last couple of times I've flown with two very small children and have felt like, wow, this is really intrusive or very difficult. And then this weekend I flew with some adult women, and I had no children with me, and breezed through and realized that some of it was just my perception that when I'm traveling with small children, it seems like a lot bigger hassle than when it's just me. I slip my shoes off, and I don't wear studded belts through the airport stuff. And so is it just sometimes maybe our own perception of what's acceptable and what's not?
Yeah, it is. And can I ask you a question? Because usually guests don't get to do this. But Janine, if you were in charge, would you have pilots go through any kind of screening except identifying themselves and walking right onto the plane?
You know, I don't know.
Why would you screen a pilot? The pilot is going to walk into the cockpit, and they're going to close the door, and they're going to be flying the plane. They don't have to take any arms or bombs on the plane, you know?
Sure.
They can take the plane, and they're going to be flying the plane. So why bother to screen them?
No, and I know what you're saying. If you opt out certain people, the lines are going to move more smoothly, and you're taking away some of the frustration. My issue was not so much with pilots, but with members of Congress doing some of the things that normal people do, just to make sure they remain aware of what life is like for the public. That was more my concern.
They don't know what life is like for the public. Most of them are millionaires. Most of them have a pension system and a health care system that is better than anything that most Americans have. They're completely isolated in Washington, D.C., and the longer they're there, the more clueless they are. So, you know, it really doesn't help much. They find out what's going on from their constituents griping about it and from watching CNN anyway. And we're delaying things. We're clogging up the lines by putting people through security who are a zero risk to any kind of airplane hijacking or bombing, who, you know, are certified, who are police officers, and who are people who can have a background check done that is very thorough. I think the previous caller is absolutely right. Our system is a really dumb system where you consider every American who walks into an airport to be a potential terrorist, and then you try to, you know, check them and pat them down and so on. It's really not a very efficient system, but it's the only one we've got. We can't do it the way the Israelis do because they have a very, very small traveling public, and we have 2 million people a day or something like that flying, and you can't do the careful interview of every single person going into every single airport. So we're sort of stuck with this as the best that we can do, I guess.
Well, also that we in fact, every American is a potential bomber. I mean, when you begin to think about the suicide bombers, and they're not just men with beards and turbans, right? Women are going through. Children have been used. Every kind of citizen has been used in terrorist activities. So while it'd be awfully nice if we could control everything through electronically on airplanes, I really don't think we can. We just don't have that kind of system. And I agree, Stefan, that if people knew what they were doing and were ready to do it so we could move through those lines a little more quickly, life would be good. Life would be good. And but if TSA would have a few more people available so that they could use all those nice scanners that we see standing empty because there's no one there manning them. That would be good as well, especially in busy airports. Yeah. In my, the one I was through was Denver, which is always clogged up and this week. And that would be good. But I think we do have to maintain a ground security as well. And again, on the pilot issue, everything goes back to me again to preparation. If you know, we worry about pilots now only because they had to scream out loud publicly to get themselves exempted. Whereas if this had been talked about earlier and worked out earlier, we would just have not, those odd issues wouldn't be there. I mean, there's a level I think of simply lack of understanding of what a public needs to know before you start putting it through different grinders.
I was talking to our board operator here, and he said, what if you have a top secret security clearance? You're allowed to look at the most top secret American government, you know, nuclear material and war plans and secret intelligence and so on. Then do you still need to go through the screening process at an airport, or have you been pretty much vetted so that you should just be able to walk onto a plane? What about Senator Ted Kennedy? He used to get stopped all the time, and they would take him aside and strip search him and do all kinds of stuff because there was some terrorist somewhere whose name was the same, and they couldn't tell the difference between an old senator and a terrorist. Well, that is just a stupidity in the system, and we need a much smarter system that can sort out people who are not terrorist threats. I don't think Chet Culver should have to go through a security check. I'm pretty sure he's not going to blow up any airplanes, and yet he has to go through them.
Okay, we're going to move on, but we wanted to just read a fun tweet we received from Jordan Weaver. He says, I don't fly often. I have little experience, but if they had supermodels do the pat-downs, my use of air travel would increase. So there you have it. Well, people who are traveling include possible presidential contenders. Over the weekend, we had Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor and 2008 Republican presidential candidate in the state. You might remember Huckabee won the Iowa caucuses 2 years ago. We have Sarah Palin coming in this weekend. When Huckabee was here, he was the keynote speaker of the Iowa Family Policy Center's Celebrate the Family event. He played down speculation that he will make another run for the nomination, but did not rule it out. Here's Mike Huckabee.
A lot of times people want to read something into every visit I ever make to Iowa and assume that there's some ulterior motive going on. And I'm not here to announce any plans or to deny any plans.
Mike Huckabee speaking in Des Moines over the weekend. He went on to say that Sarah Palin might well run away with the nomination in 2012, but he'd prefer she not run and instead endorse him. And, of course, she's going to be in West Des Moines Saturday night signing books at Borders from 6 to 9. And there's a list of rules that the store has provided for the Des Moines Register, if you go on their website, that I found interesting. What do you think of this? We're only a couple weeks out of the midterm elections, and here they are. They're back again, Professor Gronbeck.
14 months until the Iowa caucus. Yeah, they're late. They're late. They've got to get going. I mean, we certainly saw last time around, right, that by January, February, we were in we were knee deep in candidates, really rolling through after the by election of 2006. It's time to come more often during the last Iowa caucuses, most candidates were visiting the state roughly 40 times. You got to get here a lot. But both to hit different parts of the population, but also to live up to that Iowa truism, unless you shake an Iowa citizen's hand five times, you're not going to get his vote in the caucus. They're pouring in. And, of course, they're not going to announce yet. They're not going to announce until they're satisfied that they have a decent chance to go.
Well, the other thing is they can't announce legally, because
that's
if
right.
they announce, then that's the beginning of their campaign.
That's
and
right.
then all
mm-hmm.
kinds of money issues and reporting issues, Federal Election Commission and so on, kick in. So you have to delay until the very last minute so that you can spend a huge amount of money coming to Iowa and doing all kinds of things without that counting towards any kind of election. So
Right.
So let me ask you that, Stefan, because one of the things that's frustrating for political reporters like myself is these early events, as you mentioned, they won't say whether they're running. They can't say. So it's this game of we go out there and we you know, Newt Gingrich was just here a week or so ago and someone covers them. And then he says things like, well, I'm thinking about it and I'm looking at it. And there's only so many times you can write that story. And I'm not necessarily blaming them, but sometimes I wonder if we should just ignore them for the first few months and let, you know, let voters go take a look. But that is the media. Now, we won't do that, but sometimes I think we should.
You should, because they are all running for president, Janine. They're all running for president. No one comes to Iowa for a book signing who isn't running for president. I don't care who they are. Well, I mean, there are probably a few people who have written novels or something, like Jane Smiley maybe isn't running for president. But all these other people are running for president. Or at the very least, they are, you know, they're positioning themselves so that they remain relevant in the Republican Party this time around.
Can anyone then, that being said, be, if it's true that both Mike Huckabee and Sarah Palin are running and do get in, does anyone else even have a shot in Iowa? I mean, Mitt Romney got a shout out from former President Bush I and his wife Barbara Bush on Larry King the other night. They said they really like him. But does anyone have a shot if these two are in a state in which they've done well in the past?
Well, of course. McCain was certainly not the first person to come to an Iowan's thinking about a presidential candidate, given that he avoided the place and didn't come very often. There are certainly people who get the early lead, and we certainly know as well from the early polls that Palin, Huckabee, and Romney are riding high in the water right now. But there's still plenty of room for others to begin to make the move.
Yeah, and Mitt Romney is a good example.
Right.
Did you notice that Sarah Palin is not doing a book signing in New Hampshire? She is doing it in Iowa.
Right. I've got her list.
And
I
do you know
why
that she's not doing it in New Hampshire? Because Mitt Romney has New Hampshire all wrapped up around his little finger. Mm. You know, he was the local boy, the governor there, and the Republicans there will very likely go for him. It's not a very conservative Christian state. So Sarah Palin is very carefully picking where she goes. And Mitt Romney is going to be the candidate of the sort of economic Republicans, you know, the business Republicans, and not so much the social conservative Republicans. And Sarah Palin will probably be the standard bearer for them. And I think it's going to be a sort of Barack versus Hillary Clinton thing between Sarah Palin, who has huge visibility, an enormous bank account, and a stream of revenue that Rupert Murdoch is making sure remains very solid. And she's going to be a very formidable candidate. And Mitt Romney is already up raising money and will have $50 million to launch. And I think those two will be the ones to watch, frankly.
Though there's still a question, I think, about Palin. And that has, for me, has to do with how badly was she scarred in September, October, after when she was named to the ticket last time around, and found out what it would feel like just to be pounded publicly. Right now, she can dance in and out of whatever ballroom she wants to go to. She can enjoy herself, have a good time, be worshipped, make a lot of money, and live a good life, and have her daughter finish third on Dancing with the Stars. I mean, she is, and there's no doubt about it after this by-election that she thinks of herself as a wonderful king and queen maker, that she can go endorse them and pick them, and get credit for that and be a voice and a presence without being committed to much of anything.
She has an 80% approval rating among Republicans. 80%. And the siren song of the White House and the ego-inflating message, you can be president, you can be the leader of the most powerful country in the world, is something no one can resist. And I agree with you that it isn't rational, but anyone who wants to run for president has to be half crazy anyway.
That's true.
And Sarah Palin is pretty much there. So I think she's going to run.
All right. One of the things that happened late last week, as we talk about sort of Iowa politics just a little bit, without making a counteroffer, Governor Culver's bargaining team accepted a new 2-year contract agreement with the state's largest public employees union known as Ask Me. A spokesperson for Governor-elect Terry Branstad called the contract an irresponsible backroom deal. Less about the contract. This was a smart move on Ask Me's part. They feared that Branstad, who said on the campaign trail he would like state employees to begin paying for a portion of their health care, that he would push for that. So they thought, well, let's ask for not as much as we have in the past, keep it to salary alone, and get this thing done. And that's what happened. Let me ask you, Bruce Groundbeck, what should be the policy of an outgoing governor? Is, you know, do they have every right to do this? Or if they lose by 10 percentage points, should they expect that the public's going to want the new governor to hammer out this agreement?
No, they're still a governor. That's certainly within their right. I think what we see again is just a terrible timing. Not so much in the governor negotiating the contract, but in letting this come without any public notice, the union didn't actually officially put in its request for the 2% plus 1% raise until after the election, so that the union gets, if not a black eye, at least tarnished a little bit and its face a little bit dirty. And the Culver administration can say, they took furloughs last year, unpaid furloughs. They did their part, and now it's time for us to do our part. If the citizens of Iowa had been better prepared for all this, I don't think you would have given the incoming governor's staff such a wide open place to take a big swing. That it's, for me, just unbelievable sometimes that veteran politicians really don't understand some of those simplest kinds of timing and space issues that affect the way we look at them and understand them. I think they, in the end, deserve the poke that they got.
What about you, Stephen Schmidt? What about a lame duck governor, a lame duck Congress? How much do they bite off and tackle, and how much do they sit on their hands after loss?
Well, I know they always pardon all of their friends, right, that have been put in jail for corruption charges and so on. You know, so that's one thing they do. And I agree with Bruce. They can do some other nice things for people who have been nice to them. They can throw some favors at people, especially if they think that their political career is over and they're not going to run for office again. On the other hand, I think in this case, it is going to be very damaging for the Democrats, and the Democrats already got bludgeoned very, very heavily in this election to do this. Now, the only other thing that Governor Culver could do to kind of wrap up the package is to quickly appoint and get confirmation of 3 new Supreme Court justices to replace the ones that were voted out, and then really stick it to Terry Branstad. Surprised if he does that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Does this signal a willingness on his part to do that?
I think so. Yeah, I do think so. And that's fine. You know, the outgoing governors have almost nothing to lose if they don't have big political ambitions, or even if they do. You know, if Culver wants to come back into politics, the unions do turn out a lot of people. The teachers' unions are very big, especially in the Democratic Party. And so you never know. So it's probably a bad idea fiscally, because we are facing a financial crisis, and we've never talked about it. Some other time you, Janine, can have guests on and talk about the crisis of state and local and municipal governments on pensions and other benefits that are accumulating to a level where in some cases states owe more on those unfunded pensions than the entire gross domestic product of the state. I think New Jersey is a case like that. So public employees and their generous benefits, and that includes college professors and others, are something that is part of the equation of how we need to rebalance our society to some extent, because we are not a country of unlimited resources anymore.
Professor Groundbreck, we don't have a lot of time, but do you think that we will see similar aggressiveness in the lame duck Congress? I realize we only have a moment or two left, but do you expect them to tackle big issues, whether it be tax policy or don't ask, don't tell, in the days before they're gone.
I think the Obama administration is very quietly soft peddling, especially major economic moves. Don't ask, don't tell is another matter. It's getting a lot of support for killing that, and it may make that as its final move. As we say, lame ducks are still ducks. I think the Congress may well want to try something. Don't ask, don't tell is probably the easiest thing it can attempt to tackle in this period.
All right, Stefan, is that do you share that
I think
viewpoint
so. I
that
think
that's
I agree.
The more likely?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to do very much. I would hope that at least he can get Congress to ratify the START treaty with the Russians. That is something that's been in the works. It is hugely important for U.S.-Russian relations, and I think the Republicans have a moral obligation to support it because it is something that Ronald Reagan supported and Bush supported, and it is important for the United States to get their hands with the Russians around those loose nukes, and I really hope they'll do that one. I don't know if they will.
All right. You've been listening to Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Thank you, Stefan. And Bruce Gronbeck, professor emeritus of communication studies at the University of Iowa. Bruce, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We want to leave you with a couple of emails we received on the issue of TSA and airport security. Georgian Ames writes, "My doctor does a very invasive procedure to check for colon cancer. I don't want colon cancer. TSA does a very invasive procedure to prevent a bomb on a plane, and I don't want a bomb on a plane." You're listening to The Exchange, produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, with assistance from student producer Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support today from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of the program available at iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, we welcome your comments and questions at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music, composed and performed by Dan Knight. Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Janine Beck. Thanks for joining us.
Monday on The Exchange, two power brokers in the new Iowa legislature. We're talking with House Speaker Republican Craig Paulson and Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstall. Major philosophical differences separate them, but they're pledging cooperation. Legislative leaders Paulson and Gronstall, Monday on The Exchange.